Welcome to Current State, our Thursday edition. Before an extended weekend for many of you. And of course, Independence Day means fireworks. Michigan relaxed its fireworks sales law in 2012, so there are now more roadside stands and large retailers hawking their wares. One of the biggest operations in the area is the American Eagle Superstore in Lansing. And Current State's Kevin Lavery wandered through the aisles stacked with fireworks yesterday. He asked store manager Alan Elliott about what's now legal to sell.
Yes, there's a wide variety. Artillery shells, anything aerial is now legal in Michigan. Firecrackers used to be illegal. Essentially, before, all you could sell were fountains and sparklers. Now you can sell everything essentially that leaves the ground within the limits of the law.
And what kind of business have you seen so far this year? I know last year and the year before, it was just so hot and dry that it really put a damper on a lot of fireworks sales and shows in the area.
Yep. This year, it's been nice to have the rain. No threat of a drought. I know a couple years ago, Indiana had a drought throughout the year, and it really made fireworks sales go down quite a bit. But we expect to be very, very busy over the next 3 days, for sure.
Total is going to be $64.45.
Oh, my name's Al Billups, and I'm from Lansing.
I noticed just now you said, what's the loudest thing you got in the store?
Yeah. I'm looking for some illegal fireworks, but, you know, they said they don't sell any M80s. When I was a kid, that was the loudest thing. Kid threw one in between my legs. I must have jumped 6 feet in the air because it scared the hell out of me because it was so loud. But that was the old-fashioned cherry bomb, and back then they made the M80s. And I guess they don't sell anything even close. This is probably the closest that they got as far as loud, but you know, I would just look at something to bring back that memory of, you know, when I was a kid.
Now, when people buy these fireworks, Alan, do any of them ever say, how do I operate this safely? Does that ever come up? Before you do this, here's what you do.
We always preach safety in here. Some people will ask, but you know, for the most part, our staff is pretty well trained on how to use these things. So we never let anybody go out the door without knowing how to use these things safely, because if you don't, there are consequences. And one of the main keys is, you know, if you're going to be drinking, have somebody sober lighting these. That's where I would probably say 95% of the accidents happen are with people drinking a little bit too much and things get out of hand.
I'm Sheldon Grender.
What's catching your eye so far?
We've seen a couple of the huge $700 things, but they're a little out of our price range. So we're kind of looking at the, you know, $30 packs, see what we can find.
Kind of an economical 4th of July.
Yes, the frugal way to spend the holiday.
So any particular plans for fireworks this coming 4th?
It's really up in the air right now. I work at a country club, so we'll probably have some huge deal. It's a pretty big event over there, so.
It's been my experience that fireworks usually are up in the air, so nice choice of words.
All right.
And now let's get another perspective on fireworks here in the Lansing area. John Clark has been the fire chief in Delta Township since 2011. Delta's annual public fireworks display is tonight at Sharp Park, just north of the Lansing Mall. Chief Clark, thanks for joining us. Chief Clark, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh.
Hello?
Oh, hey. Hello. Chief Clark, are you there?
Yes, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Very good. It's good to have you on board. Did you catch that exchange in the American Eagle store just a minute ago? What did you make of that, if you did?
I did. He's correct. In the last couple of years, the year before last, the legislature in Michigan changed the fireworks law. Simply, basically, anything prior to that couldn't launch off the ground. You had sparklers and you had sparkler displays on the ground, but bottle rockets, firecrackers, and other things that launched through the air, Roman candles, were not allowed. And they, under the new regulation, they are allowed. So there's a lot broader prospect of what you can fire off, and with that comes much more fire danger for us and injury danger for the person that's lighting them or using them.
What is the biggest challenge the 4th of July fireworks season poses for you and your department?
Safety is probably the biggest thing, and we have two ends of that we worry about fires. This year, and the gentleman from the fireworks store spoke to it. It's not as dry this year, which is a bonus for us because the foliage is green and it's not dry, and
yeah,
and things are wet, especially today. It looks like it's going to rain until about noon, 1 o'clock, before it drops off. But it still doesn't remove the hazard of fireworks being shot off. And although they're illegal, one of the things to keep in mind is that when you discharge a fireworks, it has to be on your own property. Unless you have permission of the property owner to do it, you can't do it on somebody else's property. And you can't do it on public property. Parking lots, in our case, the fireworks, it's illegal to have fireworks in the fireworks area in the park. And most of the businesses, the mall and things surrounding that, specifically ban fireworks. Even if you fire off at home, it's got to stay in your property. So when you launch that bottle rocket, you've got to ensure it lands on your property. If it lands on your neighbor's property, it's still illegal.
Hmm.
So, and a lot of the reason for that is the danger. If you fire that bottle rocket off and you don't know where it goes and it lands in the eave of your neighbor's house or your neighbor's roof, even on a damp day today with the temperature of 1,200 to 2,000 degrees for a typical firework, it can still start a fire on the roof of a house. And a lot of times that'll smolder and you won't see it. So the fire danger is one of the big things, especially the airborne ones. The other danger is injuries itself. And he did speak to it, and he made a good point. If you're drinking, certainly, if you're impaired, you shouldn't be the one lighting off fireworks if you're a party. That's good advice, but there's still an inherent danger to lighting fireworks, as if they misfire, if the fuse doesn't burn. A lot of times the fuse will go up in and people will think it didn't go off, and they'll move that fireworks, and then it'll go off while they're moving it. So one of the, if you are going to do fireworks, we recommend you see a professional display. That's the fire safety standpoint, and the National Fire Protection Association, as well as the fire chiefs, would recommend you see a professional display, and you leave it up to them. If you are going to use fireworks, there's some big tips that you should know. One of them is that you don't want to fire them near a crowd, that you want to have the display at least 250 feet away from anybody else that's watching it, especially kids. Kids shouldn't be around the fireworks even to look at them when they're not being fired. It's like a medication. It's not something they should be around. And when you fire them off, you should always have a bucket of water there. If you light a firecracker and it doesn't fire, then you should put it in the bucket of water.
Are more Delta Township residents setting off fireworks since Michigan's law changed?
Absolutely. And we don't deal with the enforcement of it. The Sheriff's Department has to. And it's complaint-driven. They're not out looking for people that are setting off fireworks. Most of them are complaint-driven, and probably the biggest way you know it's changed is in the township, especially after dark in the evening, you'll start hearing fireworks going off, and they go off into late hours in the morning. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot more fireworks going off, at least louder fireworks than there were 2 years ago.
We hope you have a safe, well-attended event tonight in Sharp Park, north of the Lansing Mall. John Clark is the fire chief in Delta Township. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
While we'll be celebrating Independence Day here in America tomorrow, halfway around the world, July 4th also marks a national holiday in Rwanda, though it's a much more somber occasion. Current state producer Joe Lindstroth is here with more. Hi, Joe.
Mark.
So Rwandans, in Rwanda tomorrow is called Liberation Day. Is that it?
Exactly. July 4th in Rwanda is a national holiday that marks the end of the country's official mourning period for the more than 1 million people who were murdered during the genocide there in 1994. And this year, of course, is the 20th anniversary of those horrific 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last two decades since the Rwandan genocide, we've heard many inspiring stories of survival and perseverance, and we have actually one more for you today with an MSU connection.
Okay.
In 2007, Laura Apal, an associate professor in the College of Education, went over to Kigali, Rwanda's capital, to hold a therapy writing workshop for a handful of survivors of the genocide. She subsequently wrote a book of poems based on her experience called Requiem Rwanda. Laura has stayed in touch with a number of her students, including Louise Marie Mukumwezi. Louise was just a child when her entire family, her mother, her father, and three younger brothers were murdered in their home on June 6, 1994. She managed to escape. She's now working with orphans in Kigali and getting her master's degree in public health in English. And Louise credits the writing workshop with helping her move on from this pretty horrific personal tragedy. I recently spoke with both Laura and Louise about the healing power of writing. And I first asked Laura how she managed to find herself in Rwanda helping people write about memories most of us can't even imagine.
I'm a writer, and I lived in Oklahoma at the time of the bombing of the Murrah Building. And I saw afterwards the kinds of writing that people did. People who didn't generally do writing suddenly wanted to write poems and share poems. And it convinced me of the healing power of writing. Both as a writer, I experienced that, and as a teacher of writing, I experienced that. And so when I was approached in 2006 by a colleague who said, would you be interested in working in Rwanda on some sort of a healing project? I thought immediately about using writing for healing. And we went to Rwanda and collaborated with Rwandan colleagues there. And together we planned a Writing for Healing workshop.
Tell me about the workshop. How did you run it?
So our team, which had a psychiatrist and a pediatrician and myself, created a model from our experiences that combined a therapeutic model for writing with a process writing approach. So that one of the things about using writing for healing is that there's power in people who have experienced trauma going back in a safe space and interacting, repeating, going into, coming back out of that experience and realizing that it doesn't have to overwhelm them. So the therapeutic model had people write about their lives before genocide, before the trauma, during the time of the trauma, the genocide, and then after the trauma. But the writing process approach also asked people to go through several stages of writing. So they did personal, private writing at first, and increasingly worked on the writing to make it more public. So it meant that the participants in our workshop went through their experience writing several times, which gave them a feeling of control and would give them a feeling that it was safe to encounter those feelings and ideas.
Let's bring in one of your participants in your workshop. Louise Marie Mukumwezi is joining us from Kigali, Rwanda.
Yes.
Louise, why did you decide to participate in Laura's workshop?
I know Laura with that team from America. They were looking for the survivor of genocide. So that time, I was charged in psychosocial and welfare of children. So I thought maybe it will help me to do my job. I have never think that will help myself.
Laura mentioned that she asked you and the other participants in the workshop to start writing about before the genocide and memories that came before the genocide. What memories came to mind for you, Louise?
That time, Laura was the first person who asked me about my life before genocide, from the end of genocide until we did the project. Even the friend asked me, how was genocide? Where did you hide for survive? How your family have been killed? Every time I felt bad after talking with them and with many questions. Why my family didn't manage to survive? Why didn't I accept to die with them? And so on. But when Laura asked me, how are you remembered that time? I remembered many good memories.
And Louise, what can you share some of those good memories with us? What came to mind?
Yeah, memories, it's like how my mom, every night before genocide, came in our room to see how we are, how our father cooked during the party, how my parents bring me to school, how they did all their best for helping me to grow up.
Louise, it sounds like you had a special relationship with your father. What was that like?
Yeah, my father was not only my father. He was really my best friend. I have many memories to my father, but the first things I remember, he promised me to put me in the radio.
He promised to put you in the radio.
Yeah. Because that time I was a kid, I didn't know that the radio is the things, the technology, things like that. I knew that the person lived there in the radio. So every time, because my father loved the radio, I asked him, can you put me inside? Then you will always listen to me what I'm talking, what I'm dancing, everything.
You mentioned that before you met Laura, no one had asked you about your memories before the genocide. How about you, Louise? Did you ever think much about your memories before the genocide?
Before Lola, I have never. Anyways, the people asked me about genocide, how I managed to live without family, the things like that. But like Lola asked me about that, my memories before genocide. I really found it, even if they were bad things in my life, but also they are good and best things I lived before. So it always gives me the strength of going ahead, of surviving again.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Laura Apol. She's an MSU associate professor in education who held a writing workshop in Rwanda for survivors of the genocide. And joining us by phone from Rwanda is Louise Marie Mukamweze, who participated in Laura's workshop back in 2007. Laura, how does Louise's experience of writing about her memories before genocide compare with the others in your workshop? You know, she had just mentioned that no one had really asked her about her memories before the genocide, even among her friends. Was this a pretty typical experience?
My sense of it is that for a lot of people, their experiences parallel what Louise is talking about, that there's a great deal of attention that's paid to the trauma of the genocide and to the great effort of survivors who are coming out of the genocide, and that very few people do have an opportunity to think about their lives before genocide. And part of the therapeutic model was that by beginning with those memories, that there could be healing by moving from the original life before genocide through the trauma and then to the other side. So Louise talks about how happy it made her to remember her family in that way in her life. And several of the other participants said the same thing, although some of the participants also felt very sad revisiting that time. So it wasn't always a happy feeling, but it was for many of them a healing feeling.
What were your biggest challenges in getting people to write about their experiences? I can't imagine that was easy.
So I think that asking people to re-enter a part of their lives that for many reasons represents trauma to them and very often represents great unhappiness, horror, fear, requires a lot of trust. And I think that for many of our participants, it was an issue of trust all around. They had to trust us as facilitators. They had to trust the process that we were entering and asking them to enter with us. They had to trust each other and the kinds of stories that they were telling each other, the ways they were processing things with each other. And they really needed to trust themselves, that it was safe to go into some of these memories and that they were strong enough to come through it and come back out on the other side.
Louise, then Laura had you move on to write about the actual genocide. What was that like for you? Mm-hmm. What was that like for you to write about those memories?
I wrote all of the pictures of my brothers with my parents. Even when Lola came, I didn't remember their faces. But when Lola came to the hearing by writing, I did the pictures. I write all the memories from my brothers, from my mom and my dad.
Louise, how is writing about what happened different than talking about it?
Yeah, they are different because when the people when they asking you about genocide, they need to know how the people came to kill you, how your parents died. It was every time the bad experience. But the writing, you always write everything you remember. So many times you remember the good things, how God did good things, how your parents did good things.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Laura Apal. She's an MSU Associate Professor in Education who has held a writing workshop in Rwanda for survivors of the genocide. And joining us by phone from Rwanda is one of Laura's participants in the workshop, Louise Marie Mukamweze. Laura, hearing stories like Louise's, you were inspired to write a book of poems called Requiem Rwanda. Why poetry?
For me as a poet, poetry is a way that I make sense of the world. So I wrote initially because I was overwhelmed by the many feelings and the emotions that I experienced in Rwanda working with survivors. But as a poet, I also view poetry as a form of social activism, as something that I can do to make a difference in the world. And I myself had trouble imagining the kinds of numbers and the kinds of statistics that were coming out of Rwanda after the genocide. 800,000 or a million people dying in 100 days was something that I really couldn't take in. But I could think about one person's story, one person moving on in life. So for me, poetry became a way to take what were statistics that were beyond my imagining and turn them into stories that I thought could communicate on a human level and give a human face to what I was learning.
And one of these people that you wrote about in your book was Louise. Will you share the poem with us?
I will. Joe, I want to tell you a little bit about the story of where the poem came from, because over the years I've gone back to Rwanda 8 or 9 times since 2006, and I've continued to go back to do my poetry writing, and each time I make sure that I see as many of the people that I worked with as I can, and Louise is someone that I see every time when I go back. So I've seen her over these years change from her very first writing and her life at that time to where she is now. On one of the visits, Louise asked me if I would be able to stay a little bit longer because the bones of her parents and her family were being moved from a mass grave to a memorial site. And this is quite common right now in Rwanda that people's remains, it's very important in Rwanda that the remains of loved ones are treated with respect. And so it's very important that someone knows where their loved ones are buried. And Louise's family was going to be placed in a memorial. And so she asked me if I could stay and go along. And I wasn't able to do that. I needed to come back to Michigan. But I thought a lot. I was very honored that Louise asked me if I could stay and that she told me the story of what would be happening with her family. And so I wrote a poem about it. And the poem is called Dry Bones. And it begins with a verse from the Old Testament from Ezekiel 37 that says, says, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel." Dry bones. For 16 years, Louise has carried her family in her heart. Without warning, a memory will intrude, a piece of cloth, a turn of head, a bit of song. This is a fire she must feed to keep from going out. Now her parents will have a proper burial. Their bones will be moved from mass grave to memorial site. There will be a service, remembrance, stories, prayers. Louise says she will accompany her parents' bones on the move, as if anyone could know which are the remains of her family, as if at the new site anyone could keep track. But Louise has great faith. God and her parents will know. The reburial will take 3 days. As she walks with her parents across the valley of dry bones, will flesh and blood once more take shape in her mind? She does not remember her mother's hands, her father's voice, their smiles, their eyes. She cannot forgive them for dying. She does not want to know who the murderers were, has no wish for restitution. Who can restore what was taken? She does not know how to say that her once hollow self has grown strong, that her only wish now is for memory to rest, for ash to be ash, so at last she can let burn down the fire she has tended all these years.
Thank you for sharing that, Laura. Louise, how does hearing this poem about you make you feel?
Yeah, the poem is like my picture. It's a Louise who really lived the hard life, but always loved. So I love reading the poem.
And Louise, do you remember when I came to Rwanda and I showed you the poem and I said it would be in a book? And then you, I asked you if you wanted your name on the poem or if you wanted me to give you a different name.
Yeah, I said there's no problem because it's really a strong and brave Louise. There is no problem. You can put my name.
Laura, what has drawn you to Louise in particular?
Well, I think you can hear that Louise has lived through something that is hard for many of us to imagine. But she has a great heart. She has a brave spirit. She has great courage and great generosity, great love for the orphan children that she works with. And she's willing to take the risks of being connected to people, of sharing her journey and her story. And all of those things are things that have made me have great admiration for her. And I feel honored that I get to spend time with her and that she trusts me with the conversations that we have and the work that we do together.
Louise, how are you doing now?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm doing master's in public health. I have degree in clinical psychology. From that time, my life has been a meaningful to me. And I wish to live long and realize my dream and father's dreams to me. So I'm really glad.
And Laura, how has your time in Rwanda affected you? How are you different today?
Well, for one thing, if before I went to Rwanda, I believed in the healing power of writing, I believe even more in that, that writing does have power to move people and to heal people. Sometimes it's been hard to be part of this project. When I've been in Rwanda, there are times when I feel very alone and when I feel sad thinking about some unimaginable things that have happened to people that I care about, people that I will never know. And that can be overwhelming. But when I also get to meet people like Louise, like the other survivors that I've worked with, I also recognize unimaginable courage and strength, and I feel grateful and I feel honored to get to be part of their lives and to get to share this work with them.
Laura Apel is an MSU Associate Professor in Education who held a writing workshop in Rwanda for survivors of the genocide back in 2007. And Louise Marie Mukamwezi was one of Laura's participants and is now completing her master's degree in public health, and she joined us from Kigali, Rwanda. Thank you both for talking with me today.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you, Louise.
Welcome.
You probably heard about the bomb scare at Spartan Stadium yesterday in East Lansing. The Michigan State University police received a bomb threat around 3:15 p.m. To update, MSU police now have two suspects in custody. Operations were back to normal in the area around Spartan Stadium not long after the incident. The area was evacuated. Nothing was found. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Andy Warhol is perhaps the most recognizable name in 20th century American art. One factor in his popularity is the many album covers he designed. At the Cranbrook Art Museum in Bloomfield Hills, an extensive collection of Andy Warhol's album art is on display through March 15th of next year. Current State Scott Pohl has been to the museum to see almost 40 years of his work. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
I'm well. I didn't know Warhol was responsible for so many album covers, but he did this a long time.
You know, it's kind of amazing how much of his career was devoted to album art. And when you think of Andy Warhol's album covers, a couple leap immediately to mind: the iconic banana that graced the cover of the Velvet Underground in Nico, and the working pants zipper in the cover of the Rolling Stones album Sticky Fingers.
Sure.
What you may not know is that as a graphic design artist, Warhol's album work dates back to the late 1940s in some completely non-rock and roll albums. Cranbrook Art Museum curator of contemporary art and design, Laura Mott, showed me around Warhol on Vinyl, the record covers, 1949 to 1987.
At Cranbrook, we've had a very long history with design. So we really see this exhibition, Warhol on Vinyl, the record covers, as looking at his graphic design career in addition to his fine art career. We've also been the benefactor of many Andy Warhol works in recent years. The Andy Warhol Foundation for Visual Arts gifted us 154 Polaroids. We also have on view 9 recent prints that were gifted to us. And this collection of record covers just came into our collection.
What will people see? The actual album covers, the artwork that went onto the album covers, what is included in the exhibition?
We have nearly 100 albums on view here, and this ranges from the extremely rare, we have one album here in the exhibition that there's only one known in the world, to the widely recognizable, like Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers. And that really shows you the reach of Andy Warhol. So there's 60 unique album covers within the exhibition, and then, like any other printmaking medium, they were distributed in different color variations, size variations, so we also have some of those on view as well.
Let's have a look.
All right, come on. So this is Andy Warhol's very first record cover, A Program of Mexican Music. This is a recording of a concert that was done in conjunction with an exhibition on Mexican art. And what's really fascinating about this cover is that the concert itself was performed by musicians who had instruments that were reconstructed based on a 16th century document that Spanish conquistadors had created about what they saw Aztec musicians to be playing. So they reconstructed the instruments and had a concert. And for the record cover, Andy Warhol is looking at the exact same 16th century document. We have here an image from the Codex Florentinus, and you see him replicating that on the cover. But what he does is he, you know, changes it up and makes it look like a comic strip. You also see these dark black lines, which is very reminiscent of abstract expressionism, which in the late 40s, of course, was the avant-garde of art.
This reminds me of a lot of classical music album covers from that era in terms of the text on the cover telling you what the album is. The artwork is really only a third or less of what we're looking at here. Pretty standard for that era?
Yes. What you'll see in these beginning record albums is that the graphic designer or commercial illustrator was tasked with visualizing the music. And in these early record covers, you'll see that the musician was not typically included on the cover. There was more focus on the type of music. For instance, you know, the music lover of jazz would be attracted to this album cover. The music lover of classical would be attracted to this album cover. So you see in these early record albums a lot of whimsical drawings that Warhol is trying to depict the music visually, or a concentration on the instrument of, you know, the lead musician. Nightbeat here is a... there's only one known in the world. This is on loan from Par Marchal, who is a Quebec scholar and collector. And you know, this was a album that only went to radio stations. It contains a sort of film noir radio drama called Nightbeat that was quite popular. It had a weekly broadcast. So these were coming in and out of radio stations. They weren't seen as sort of precious objects, and they were never sold to the public. And so this has been known about for about 10 years, and they still haven't been able to locate another one. So to have sort of a one-of-a-kind is quite an extraordinary thing to see.
Laura Mott of the Cranbrook Art Museum. Count Basie.
This is perhaps my favorite record in the entire exhibition. This is also his very first celebrity portrait. We know Andy Warhol for his iconic images, serial images of the rich and famous and celebrities such as Elvis and Marilyn. But this is his very first celebrity portrait that he does. And this image, it's a really strikingly, kind of really beautiful drawing, right, that he's doing based on a photograph. And Andy Warhol working directly from photographs is what he did throughout his entire career. So again, we see this early graphic illustrator career being the conduit to the famous pop iconic artist that we know today. This image of Count Basie is really striking. It's also shows this moment in the mid-50s where the record cover starts to change. Elvis has become very popular, and so the record industry, you know, it really wants to connect with the youth market, and so they start selling a persona to match the music rather than just a music style. And so we see here Count Basie looking very exceptionally cool as a jazz musician, looking off to the side. But also, this is a very rare way to see Andy Warhol, because he has this gentle ink wash he's doing over the face, which gives it volume and dimension, which is very rare to find in Andy Warhol work.
Commercially, the imagery becomes as important or more important than the music.
Most definitely. And when we think about music industry today, you think about Lady Gaga or something, I mean, their persona actually is more present than the music. So we really see this history of the music industry within this exhibition as well.
These look like signs you would see in Walmart or someplace.
You got it. This is his very first pop art record cover and one of his very first edition screen prints. This is his cover for Giant Size, $1.57 each. And this marks a significant shift. We've now entered into 1963, where Warhol is known as a pop artist. He first exhibited his Campbell soup cans in 1962, and this was done for an exhibition, The Popular Image. This is a legendary exhibition that happened in Washington, D.C. It included Jasper Johns, Tom Wesselman, Klaus Oldenburg, James Rosenquist, Robert Rauschenberg. This was an exhibition that really launched those careers and helped name that movement of pop art. And so this album cover was taken from a supermarket poster. And this is him, you know, again, appropriating directly from everyday life and shifting the context into an artwork. We also have on view here four reproductions. And this opens up a really interesting conversation about Andy Warhol's artwork, because where does the artwork lie? Is it in the image itself, because it's not an original image? Or is it the idea? Is it the appropriation? So there is a question of, you know, is a copy of a copy any less authentic? So now we've entered to the 1960s, and Warhol has become an iconic artist quite quickly, well known as a pop artist, and he himself is becoming a popular image. And so he is very much a part of the avant-garde art scene in New York City, and that's where he goes and sees a little known band called the Velvet Underground in the Lower East Side in a concert, and he decides he wants to produce the band. He adds Nico, the singer, who's to the band, and he produces the Velvet Underground and Nico in 1967.
Sunday morning brings the dawning. It's just a restless feeling by my side.
This is an iconic image of the banana. There's no mention of the band, there's no mention of the type of music. It has a banana and the name of Andy Warhol, because at this moment, Andy Warhol was better known than the band. The other thing that's incredible about this album is that Andy Warhol is really thinking about the medium of the record, which was meant to be handled. So the banana, in fact, is a sticker. And when you peel it off, very suggestively underneath is a pink banana. He had several other Discovery albums. Most notable would be the original pressings of Sticky Fingers. There's a couple of versions of Sticky Fingers in the exhibition, because the very first pressing of it had a very large zipper. And the zipper was so large that every time you put other albums up against it, it would destroy the cover. So we have the first zipper. They didn't then made it even smaller to a second zipper. And then in reprints, they just lost the zipper altogether, and you just see the image. This is a very important moment within the history of Warhol, because he saw the record cover as a way to disseminate his name as an artist. And here he's finally being collected by the masses. So only a few people can own a painting or a print, but millions of people can own Rolling Stone Sticky Fingers.
And it's a great album.
And it's a great album.
I'm with Laura Mott of the Cranbrook Art Museum, which has an extensive Andy Warhol album collection exhibition right now. And, you know, as someone who grew up in the era when albums came on vinyl and they were these square things that you could hold and open and study, to the era of CDs where the images are much smaller, to the download era where frequently we don't pay any attention to the artwork at all. You can barely see it on the screen of your telephone, for instance. It's kind of a shame that people were exposed to art extensively if they were interested in music, and that doesn't happen like that anymore.
Well, within this exhibition, we have a listening room where we have a collection of about 15 of these albums where you can actually hold the album and play on a record player. It's really important to make that connection between the cover art, the object of the vinyl album, and the music as Warhol conceived these albums to be understood.
Vinyl's coming back, and I think that might bring the artwork back too.
I think so too. There's a lot of young teenagers who've come to the exhibition who've talked about how they now collect vinyl. I myself collect vinyl. A lot of the other artists here who are part of the Cranbrook Art Academy, they collect vinyl. So there is something about this desirability for this relationship between the artwork, the image, and the music itself.
Laura Mott is curator of contemporary art and design at the Cranbrook Art Museum. Thank you so much. A fascinating exhibition of Andy Warhol's album art.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl. We'll be right back.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Harry Wickham was a turn of the 20th century Grand Rapids insurance salesman and model. Wickham posed as the character Mr. Rover, a traveling dandy who was pictured on postcards and scenes all around Grand Rapids and West Michigan, in front of notable buildings and scenic areas. The cards, which were sponsored by and promoted area businesses, have become highly desirable among collectors. But the whimsical Mr. Rover had a darker side. Harry Wickham was suspected by some of embezzlement and other crimes. He fled Grand Rapids, reappeared in other U.S. cities, then vanished again for long periods. The life and times of Harry Wickham have been studied by Melissa Fox of the Grand Rapids Public Library and were featured in the article Larger Than Life in the May-June issue of Michigan History magazine. Current State's Peter Wharf spoke with Melissa Fox by phone last week. Fox shared the story of Mr. Rover.
He was born and raised in Grand Rapids, and in the beginning of early 1900s, he started working as an insurance agent. And about 1907, he started modeling for these postcards.
Yeah, how did he get that job?
That was a kind of the most common question I get about this. I've done a couple presentations on it too, and I think it has mostly to do with proximity. And I think he went to high school with the folks who produced the postcards, the Reed Tandler Company. I think the postcards served as a travel piece for Grand Rapids, but also as marketing for the Reed Tandler Company and for Harry Wickham as an insurance agent. He was also pretty handsome, as you might notice in the cards.
Right.
So I think that didn't hurt. But before he modeled for the cards, he also married a young woman from Big Rapids whose father was kind of notorious there. And so he modeled for these cards, and then about the next year, he kind of disappeared from Grand Rapids and didn't come back for about 10 years doing something totally different. The reason for his disappearance is kind of up in the air, but as I said, he married this young woman from Big Rapids, and her father had caused the Northern National Bank in Big Rapids to fail because he was embezzling money, and that caused a big stir. There were a few people looking for him, and he has supposedly faked his own death to avoid these creditors. And so these two stories are kind of tied together. And Harry and Kitty left Grand Rapids, I think, because they probably didn't want to get tangled up in the mess from her father's issues there. But they went to Chicago, they went to New Orleans, they went to Cuba. They ended up both lived in Indiana for a while, in Indianapolis, and that's where they both died.
Let me ask you about the Mr. Rover cards. Mr. Rover is the sort of alter ego of Harry Wickham, who, as you say, photographs well, and he has kind of a connection to this series of postcards, which are what?
So they're categorized as exaggeration postcards, and they feature Harry Wickham, kind of a really larger-than-life image, leaning over City Hall, like with his elbow on the clock tower of City Hall, and stomping across the Grand River and eating picnics in the park, but he's a huge exaggerated image, kind of what you might see in other travel postcards where it's like a huge ear of corn on a wagon or like a large fish coming out of the lake on a guy's fishing reel, something like that.
Right. And then Harry Wickham, during this period of his life, he sort of disappears and then resurfaces in places quite distant around the country. And is he thought of or tied into this sort of scandal in any way?
Well, that's kind of how I came to find out really about the scandal, was looking at historical newspapers. His name started to come up. So, for example, when his father-in-law's body was exhumed to prove his death, it was national news across the country, and Harry Wickham was the person who identified his body. So I think there's a natural tie between these stories because Harry Wickham's wife had inherited a bunch of money, both from insurance from her father's death, like a life insurance policy, but also from some of his businesses. She inherited money there, too. So I think Harry and Kitty kind of fled Grand Rapids with that money before the creditors could chase them down. So, yeah, and they moved around the country to Chicago. They both had family there. Their passage to Cuba, I think, is most interesting to me.
Yes.
And I think there, at that same time, was a company in Grand Rapids that had settled a large part of Cuba, a kind of a settlement in Cuba called Magnolia. And they were selling it as a great investment, which was also kind of clearly a scam, I think. And so I don't know if Kitty's father did fake his death and ended up in Cuba or not. I haven't been able to prove that, but that I think is probably where the story goes.
Right. He seems to be a character that is always sort of on the edge of society, on the edge of believability, maybe just on the edge of the law and lawlessness. Would you characterize that as accurate?
I would, yeah. I often, when I was researching this, thought of Harry Wickham as kind of that Leonardo DiCaprio character in Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
You know, kind of always on the verge of being caught, but also really pretty suave, and he was handsome, and he was a salesman. So, you know, pretty easy to fit into society and play that part.
Tell me about the cards and sort of their collectability in Western Michigan. Can you give me a little bit of that story?
Yeah, they're among the most highly collected postcards in West Michigan.
Yeah.
There are 28 of them. We have 8 in our collection at the library. So to kind of see all of them, I had to pull from many collectors so that I could show them in my presentations. And one really rare one is only owned by the museum that we know of.
These are 28 different scenes of places around Grand Rapids and Western Michigan. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And some of those places are no longer in existence. And, you know, he's at parks, several different parks. He's in front of the library on a big chair, kicked back, reading a book, eating dinner at some of the hotels. They're outside scenes, so he's outside of these buildings. But one of the collectors has tried to find if there are other similar versions of these across the country, like if they were, you know, a trend then. And we haven't been able to find any that were as well done as these ones are. So I think it speaks to kind of the ingenuity of the cards themselves and also to Harry Wickham as the character who played this guy so well.
Right. And could you sort of describe generally what these cards look like? Wickham, as your title of your article indicates, is larger than life.
Right. So he stands, I would say he's at least double the size of the building that
right.
he stands in front of. And he has a very quirky kind of personality, very mischievous looks on his face in many of them. Like, he knows what he's up to, and he knows he's larger than life in these images. So it kind of sells them in that way. They're all black and white, and just of places around Grand Rapids during that time, so before 1910, that were hot spots in the city.
Yeah, he's very nattily dressed, has sort of a jaunty look about him, wearing a hat and an expression of something almost as if he knows something that you don't know.
Right. Exactly.
Melissa Fox is with the Grand Rapids Public Library, author of the recent article, Larger Than Life, from Michigan History Magazine. Melissa, thanks so much for your time and the conversation.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
That's our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll look at the Lansing Electronics Extravaganza. We'll also speak with June Hewitt, the new provost at Michigan State University. And next Friday, a reminder, we'll be hosting Democratic candidate for Governor Mark Schauer for a live statewide call-in. That and more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Many thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and to Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Enjoy the 4th. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.